They're going to the hardest to reach places, whether it's taking a motorbike in Western Africa or whether it is crossing rivers, and then they're not even getting compensated.
Welcome to this week's episode of Contain This. This week, Dr. Lara Andrews, the Acting Director of the Indo-Pacific Center for Health Security, talks to Dr. Rupa Dutt, the Executive Director of Women in Global Health. Rupa served as the President of the International Federation for Medical Students Associations and is now a practicing primary care physician in Washington, D.C. In this episode, Rupa talks about how her identity as an Indian-born American woman shaped her motivation to help found the advocacy group Women in Global Health more than 5 years ago. On the 17th of September, Women in Global Health held a virtual summit on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly, where countries from all around the world, including Australia, reaffirmed their commitment to the Sustainable Development Goal No. 5, to achieve gender equity and empowerment of all women and girls, and to gender-responsive leadership during the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Adam Craig. Enjoy this episode with Lara Andrews and Rupa Dutt.
So, Dr. Rupa Dutt, welcome and thank you for joining our podcast series, Contain This. Before we talk about your work in Women in Global Health, I'd just like to start to ask you if you could share some of your personal story as a woman in global health and how you got to this point.
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you, Laura. So my background is I'm actually a clinician as well, in addition to being a global health policy advocate. I started engaging with global health a little over a decade ago through student leadership, and I was the president of the International Federation of Medical Students Associations. That's a mouthful. But through that real, early on engagement, I was able to see global health at multiple levels. So at the front lines, I was training and seeing women all around, nurses, doctors, being majority of the health workforce. And then in the global health policymaking space, there were so many talented technical officers and other experts all around, advocates. But whether I was in the hospital or whether I was at a multilateral, the World Health Organization or other UN agencies, really noticed that women were not at the most senior levels. And, we started unpacking that through Women in Global Health. But my personal journey is I've always been really keen to work on health inequities. I am Indian American, so I was born in India, but came to the US when I was 5 years old and sort of just grew up between those dualities. And for those of us that have, in a way, two roots, we see, the world really as one planet and interconnected. And I just really had a drive to work on health inequities. And through working on health inequities, it's hard to look at one intersection without looking at gender, racial, broader socioeconomic, and then contextualizing it with my heritage, especially with India, the caste and religion also becomes more prominent. So I've always approached global health really from that intersectionality lens, and that's shaped a lot of what I do. And I would say that it was really during clinical training when I was working those 80 to 100 hour shifts, and we're not supposed to work more than 80 hours, but we do end up doing that in clinical training, and seeing that just women were majority of the workforce, but we're not in decision-making. Where I trained, still haven't had a single woman lead as a program director or as a department of chair of medicine. And so these type of stark reminders just really showed me that, as I see myself in the field of health, what can I do now to really make sure it's more equitable and it's more diverse, and that the ideas of women like me can really shape health decision-making, because not only because it's the right thing to do, but it's really the smart thing to do as well.
Yes, and you talked about both the inequities, but also the disparity in leadership in your own experience. Did you face barriers as an individual, and how did you overcome them?
Yeah, that's a really great question, and it's one that I think about often, because the answer does change as you go through deeper self-reflection and understand you know, how gender norms and bias really are part of your life. They're sort of the invisible molecules that are floating around in every interaction, whether it is your own individual engagement with society or the interpersonal or within an organization or wider community and society level. And so I'd say that for me, you know, early on, I really found myself to be very privileged in the fact that I was able to pursue higher education and grew up in a cultural context where it was encouraged for me to really pursue higher education in the United States, whereas where I come from, there is a lot more earlier marriage that happens. There's less priority investment in girls. So I think that for a big chunk of my early years, I just felt like I was so privileged as a young woman. But it was really when I entered leadership roles that I started facing challenges that didn't quite make sense to me. And it was actually a friend of mine from Sweden, a colleague, who started really probing and asking questions. Do you feel like this would be the same experience if you were a male? And I said, you know, that's a really great question. And this was, again, a little over a decade ago that I started unpacking the experiences of what women face and what men face. And now it's to the point where I feel like every interaction, whether it is, you know, sharing household responsibilities, sometimes my partner and I are counting the hours, like who's doing what, just to make sure it's equitable or as we plan our future. So I think it is definitely all around, but it does take the effort to really, you know, put those glasses on and look at things from a gender lens in your own context.
Rupert, you're absolutely right. And as I was listening to you talk about privilege and equity, it really reminded me how important it is for us to bear in mind that as women around the world, we don't share the same access to opportunities. So thank you for raising that point about gender lenses. And Rupert, Women in Global Health, you're a co-founder and executive director. Can you tell me a bit more about the organization, what it's aiming to achieve and how it's grown?
It really also came from the same passion that I was talking about of seeing this pyramid of 70% of the health and social workforce are women. But when you look at top leadership roles, women only occupy 25%. And in the private sector, that's less than 5% of senior leadership roles in Fortune 500 healthcare companies. And we found ourselves as early career women seeing the talent, but not seeing it represented in leadership and wanting to do something about it and not just call it out, but really solution oriented. So I actually met two of my co-founders on social media through Twitter. This was in 2015 when Twitter was just starting to become a platform for those of us in global health to engage. A senior woman leader had launched a campaign on social media called hashtag WGH100 to name 100 women working in global health to counter the all-male panels that were happening or the mantle that was mantles that were happening in global health. And so there was a lot of noise in our global health community from senior women and clear frustration. And so a group of us early career women who didn't quite know each other, but we aligned on values and met through social media and connected through Skype calls from all around the world, decided to really take this online conversation into a global campaign. We went to the World Health Assembly in 2015 without any, you know, funding or resources, but just really a strong drive, and we used our existing networks from our student days and other groups that we were part of, young professional groups, to bring the conversation to the World Health Assembly sidelines. And so I often say that Women in Global Health is a movement first and an organization second. Our mission is really to challenge power and privilege to challenge power and privilege for gender equity in health. And for us, what that really means is, again, taking the conversation from fixing women to fixing systems, looking at structural barriers, and really looking at how do we change the environment to be enabling for all genders. And so this conversation for the 21st century for us is really about creating gender transformative culture as both an individual leadership practice, but also an organizational way of doing things.
And the support for the movement, as you describe it, I guess is evidenced in how many people have now got behind it and the reach that Women in Global Health now has, which is really fantastic.
the demand really comes from the women in this space. We never imagined that we would be forming chapters around the world. Actually, it was women on their own that started creating communities of global health and really wanting to create a platform in their local context. And so that's what really inspired the Women in Global Health chapters to form.
Great. And I understand that the Australasian chapter is in the process of being established.
Yes, it's in an incubating phase right now. And what we have done is we want to provide all of our communities that are forming around the world an opportunity to engage with the movement. Some of them will, you know, go on to become formal chapters. And so they have about a year to come together and identify what are their local objectives and goals and how they plan to bring all actors together under the Women in Global Health agenda. And one of the unique things about our networks is that we really want to engage all women working in health and all allies from all different genders. And so that means whether you're a physician, a nurse, a health worker, researcher, policymaker, someone that works in communications, private sector, government person, we want everybody to be really engaging together. There's too many siloed things that happen in our field. And so for us to work on gender equality and women's leadership, we really wanted this conversation to be bringing everybody under one umbrella of the Women in Global Health movement. And that way really seeing how we can, again, collaborate and use collective action as a key pillar to driving the social change.
And we are really looking forward to the Australasian chapter connecting a network of leaders across our region. And this comes at a really critical time in the middle of the COVID pandemic, of course. Rupa, Women in Global Health have issued 5 R's for health security. Can you talk me through those 5 R's and why they're so important?
Yes. And, you know, these 5 asks are really grounded in what we felt based on what we were seeing in the early weeks of the COVID-19 disease outbreak and the pandemic was really around the fact that there was gender blind aspects to the response, but there were also gender implications to COVID-19 that were not getting visibility, were not getting measured. And so what we did is we really brought these asks together based on Women in Global Health's unique position to connect with women in health, as well as our partners that are working closely on these issues. So our 5 asks is, one is really around ensuring that there is equal representation in decision-making around COVID-19. This is about ensuring that women are represented in equal numbers in all decision-making COVID-19 task teams and working groups. Right now what we're seeing is a very stark gap. As I'd mentioned, it's about 25% of the senior leadership roles are women, but in COVID-19, we're seeing that women are representing less than 12% of these roles on COVID-19 task teams. We've looked at about 87 countries and 114 task teams. The data will be published shortly. So that is a very high number. It means that more than 8 out of 10 task teams are majority men making decisions. The second is really around, you know, what we call it is that it's about time to really make sure that applause is great, but safe and decent work is better for health and social workers. We are seeing a global recognition of health workers and all those applauses and all the applause and all the sort of lighting candles is appreciated, but we really need to make sure our health workers are protected. They have appropriate physical protective equipment, PPE, often designed for male bodies and not for female bodies, oversized. We've seen photos of women having to use duct tape to have them fit their body. We also know that a lot of the working hours are not designed in a way to realize that women have a triple shift. They have their health worker job. Then they also have the added responsibility of taking on COVID-19 pandemic. And then they have increased home and social care responsibilities, often for children, elderly, and community. And so we're not factoring this in when we are looking at the decent work conditions for health workers. And then the psychosocial support and mental support for our health workers is significantly lacking. So this is really about how do we create safe and decent work conditions. We've heard from some of our frontline workers in Pakistan and India that they're facing violence when they're going into communities because of just the intensity of how long this pandemic has been going on, and the financial insecurities, the food insecurities. There's a lot of frustration and anger, and it's usually the health workers that face the brunt of it. And these are, again, women at the front line. Our third ask is really around ensuring that we compensate and end unpaid work and really formalize the informal jobs in the health sector. Currently, women's contributions in the health sector, 50% of them are unpaid, which is $1.3 trillion. And I'll say that again, half of what women do in the health sector is currently in unpaid work. And so this is really something that the pandemic has showed a lot of spotlight on. In most countries where we're seeing jobs being lost first are the informal jobs, and mainly women. And so we really see that this is a critical ask to make sure that the house of cards doesn't come tumbling down. We're counting on the poorest women to subsidize global health. And in some countries, we're seeing women are waiting even up to 6 months to get hazard pay or to even just get their baseline stipend as community health workers. The fourth is what we're really saying. We're currently operating blind, and we need to have gender responsive data collection, which is having both sex disaggregated, but also gender data. And the more we can get disaggregated, right now, there are only 52 countries around the world that are providing sex disaggregated data to WHO, the World Health Organization, and many multilaterals are really trying hard to get this data so we at least know who is getting infected, who is getting tested, who is dying. We don't have data based on health workers' infections. And so there's a lot of call for, you know, ending the fact that we're currently working blind. And the fifth part is really around ensuring that we fund women's movements and community-led initiatives. Right now in a pandemic, it is really critical that social protections are there, and most countries don't have strong social protection systems. We know very few use even 1% of their budget for health. And so a lot of what we're asking for is around making sure that money gets into the hands of women's groups, especially in lower middle-income countries. And currently, overseas development assistance shows less than 1% goes to women. It's also about making sure investments in COVID-19 are gender responsive, getting into the hands of women, and ideally everything includes a gender marker.
Rupa, you mentioned in those asks, you mentioned about the unpaid work, and it's certainly my eyebrows raised with the 1.36 billion that is in unpaid labor by women. Can you give some examples of the sort of unpaid contribution that women give to the health workforce?
Yeah, and the number is $1.3 trillion annually, and that is really a number that to learn more about it, you can go to the Lancet Women in Health Commission from 2015, which was worked by included health economists that came to these numbers. They actually say that it's an underestimate. It's probably even more than that. And examples include, if we'll take a look at the country India, it's dependent on what's called frontline workers, ASHAs, auxiliary nurses. They don't get a salary. They're giving stipends, and stipends are based on how often you deliver a particular service, whether it is giving a vaccine or doing a screening. And these are often, priced at pennies. So it all depends on, you know, how much you can cover, and it's non-reliable or unreliable, you know, ways of getting income. In other places, we've also seen, I'm just pulling now from the other continent, Africa, we know that instead of getting actually financial stipends, the compensation is in the form of getting a access to a mobile, like a cell phone or some sort of technology, and or access to being able to distribute drugs. And we know how problematic that is, because it means that those people have to find other ways of making income or creating, you know, it also does set up, you know, all sorts of circles of just, you know, unethical aspects in many different ways. And so this is what we mean by some of the unpaid work in the health sector. And in case there are any sort of, let's say, issues such as like what we're seeing in the pandemic, like the health systems and are changing or stopping services, these health workers have no mechanism to ask for compensation or to ask for, you know, wage coverage during these time of periods, because they're not considered part of the health system, even though they're the ones at the front line doing all the screening in COVID-19.
And I think that speaks to that issue of intersectionality of, in these cases, people in poverty without the power and the voice to be able to speak or negotiate for formal recognition of what they're contributing.
You know, it's also just the physical risk they take too. We were hearing from a community health worker organized by our India chapter, these power dialogues. I mean, some of these women have no PPE, no physical protective equipment, are expected to cross rivers, become soaked in their clothes, and then have no place, no, you know, sanitation, hygiene to clean themselves. And then they're expected to test for COVID-19. And then come all the way back across these rivers. And, you know, they're going to the hardest to reach places, whether it's taking a motorbike in Western Africa or whether it is crossing rivers. And then they're not even getting compensated. So it's all, you know, I think there's really a wake up call during this pandemic. Can we continue to build health systems and say we're truly secure when this is how we're setting our health systems up to be?
Absolutely. Rupa, I was going to ask, you've identified problems and solutions in the five asks. Do you have examples of where countries or organizations have implemented these solutions and we have seen change?
Yeah, so one of the really inspiring stories is actually what's taking place in Somalia. So Somalia is where we started our second Women in Global Health chapter, and it was all led by women self-organizing. Somalia is a fragile state, currently, you know, considered to be five governments running one country, so quite a complex place with still active conflict going on. And our Somalia chapter started engaging with the global campaign on five asks and realized that there were two things that weren't happening in Somalia that they really wanted to work on. And the first one was really around the data aspect. They noticed that the government was not reporting back sex disaggregated data, nor looking at the gender implications. And the second thing was really around ensuring that women were part of the decision-making that was happening in Somalia. So what they did is they started mobilizing, including working with other women networks and other community health workers networks in Somalia, engaging with the media, and also debriefing the ministry on how, one, that it was a problem, and two, how could they start collecting data and use the talent of the research talent that existed in Somalia or part of the diaspora. And so what the sort of positive outcome is that the Ministry of Health is working with our chapter and the women that are connected to the chapter to start looking at both sex and gender disaggregated data. It's not complete yet, but it's work in progress, and they've started providing some information. So that's been really great. The second one, which they're, you know, facing some challenges on, is really getting women into decision-making roles. What's happened is that there are now at least one or two women in some of the task teams, working groups, but it is a bit more tokenistic representation. And quoting the words of Amina Jama, who leads the Women in Cobalt Somalia chapter, she says, you know, no more tokenism, no more window dressing. And that's sort of the slogan that she's been championing in Somalia. And she actually shared that with Dr. Tedros at WHO that, you know, we don't want the tokenism or window dressing. We really want women in leadership roles. So that's an example where it's work in progress. And we have seen where there are quotas in place, that's where women are getting opportunities. And we know that you have to reach a critical mass of at least getting 30% women for it to start really showing some of this, environment where you can say what it is truly gender inclusive.
They are both really excellent examples, and particularly on the data, to hear that the work of the women in engaging with the ministry is actually progressing. And also in the context of what you raised before, that only 52 countries are reporting sex disaggregated data. So I think that's truly inspiring to hear how much progress they're making, particularly as you mentioned, in a country that is incredibly complex. So I think that's a lesson to us all about what you can achieve when you really work together and you decide the issue is important enough to advocate strongly on. Thank you for that. Rupa, Women in Global Health have written that coronavirus will define our time and fundamentally reshape our world. For many, World War II was a defining event in global history. For women in the US, Europe in particular, one of the consequences of men going off to war was the opportunity for women to engage in formal paid work and demonstration that women had the capacity and ability to perform what had previously been considered men's work. Do you think we will see unplanned but positive changes for women as a result of the COVID pandemic?
Laura, you know, one of the things that is happening around COVID-19 is that women are mobilizing in so many ways, and the woman power is out there. I am confident that we are going to be building back better and seeing those headlines in almost every newspaper around the world of how women leaders are outperforming male leaders as head of governments. And I'm not here to say that women are better than men, but there's something about the leadership style that is really being recognized. So I'm very confident that we're going to be coming out of this pandemic recognizing women and valuing women. But, you know, this is not going to happen on its own. So I encourage everyone to really continue to, break out of the echo chamber and ensure that we truly recognize women's, leadership and gender equality. Everything that we're asking for and we've been discussing in today's conversation, these are not new things. These are all commitments that have been made before, but right now is the opportunity to build back better and really build back in a gender responsive way. So I'm very confident on the other side of all of this, that this time it's not just going to be in high resource settings, but really in all settings around the world that we have more gender equitable health systems.
Rupa, thank you for that. And I think the messages are clear. We will look forward to seeing this work being progressed in our region through the Australasian chapter as it becomes established. And I think you're right. There's an opportunity and a window for us now to move forward, particularly with women in leadership, and the work of Women in Global Health is inspirational for us all. So I'd like to thank you for your time joining us for this interview, for sharing with us your story, the work of Women in Global Health, and we look forward to hearing and seeing more and also contributing to the very, very important agenda of greater gender equality in global health. Thank you, Dr. Rupa Datt.
Thank you for this, this opportunity and platform, and really look forward to engaging with you and others in the community, because only through collective action can we really achieve gender equality.
Great. Thank you very much.